Good day and welcome to this Cigna Drug and Alcohol Awareness Series conference call. Today's conference is being recorded. At this time, I would like to turn the conference over to Amy Papageorge. Please go ahead.
Hello and thank you for joining us. My name is Amy Papageorge and I'm a therapist and care manager for the substance abuse team at Cigna. Due to the format of this seminar, you will not be able to ask questions during the talk, but there will be an opportunity to ask questions at the end. Following today's presentation, you will be asked to participate in a brief 5-question survey so that we can get your feedback regarding your experience in today's seminar. After the survey, you will be able to ask our speaker questions regarding his talk. Please limit your questions to the seminar topic. If you have specific questions regarding substance abuse treatment or your policy, please contact the outpatient team by calling the number on the back of your insurance card. There is a PowerPoint for today's seminar available online. To access the PowerPoint, go to www.cigna.com/substance abuse and then click on today's presentation. Again, that's www.cigna.com/substance abuse and then click on today's presentation. Today I have the pleasure of introducing Timothy Trail. Tim conducts neurological and substance use-based research at the University of North Texas. He's the coordinator of the Substance Abuse Resource Center at UNT and sits on the Subcommittee for Recovery in Higher Education for the state of Texas. Tim presents his research at conferences, community programs, university classrooms, and addictions treatment centers across the nation. Tim?
Hello, everybody. Welcome to today's webinar. I really appreciate you having me here. I'm just going to jump right into it since that was such a wonderful introduction, and I'll get right into it. So I'm going to try to explain some of the slides. It may get a little bit tedious for some people, but I want to make sure that anyone on the phone who has a visual impairment can also know what we're talking about also, who may not be able to see the slides because they're a little pictorial-based. So I am giving this one. I gave one very similar to this about a year ago or so, and the reason I really like to do this presentation, it's from kind of the basics of addiction and approaches from a very different, it's a very unique approach. So I look at things electrically in the brain instead of through fMRIs and CAT scans and those kind of things. I look at things electrically. And what I've found speaking with doctors and researchers and patients and clients all over is that people tend to really have a much clearer, a much simpler understanding. It's much simpler to understand, I should say, looking at it this way, whether it is addictions or anxiety or depression or whatever. And so we want to cover the basics of that and see if we can't present it in a really easy to way understanding. So anyway, let me jump right into it, or I'll start rambling like crazy. So the first slide is just an introduction slide. The second slide is kind of a confusing slide. It just has lots and lots of words like rehab and hope and AA and choice and recovery and tolerance and la, 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 lots and lots of them. And that's because the field of substance abuse disorder, or addictions, as we used to call it, it can be very clouded, and there's just a lot of information, and there's a lot of ways and a lot of styles of treatment and a lot of opinions, and fortunately, there's a lot of research going into it now also. And so today, I'm hoping to clarify for some people this way of looking at addictions, and this is not the only way, of course, and I'm sure there are some doctors online that have this a much deeper outlook than what we're going to present today. But this is a good way. I'd ask you to keep an open mind. This is a great way to explain to someone and for someone to come into an understanding. And a lot of times I can see that kind of that pressure coming off of people's shoulders when I talk about this, whether it's in a treatment center or with a client face-to-face. So anyway, so the next slide, which is the third slide, is a picture of Homer Simpson with a little tiny brain in his head, which is just so fun when I like to always show people because it's silly, and I like to have a lot of fun. So Now, the fourth slide, this is one that's really important. It says the four major areas, and it's a picture roughly of someone's head and the brain, and it's split into four areas. Now, you can look on those, if you'd like, the third and the fourth area, the autonomic nervous system, and the fourth area is the medulla. I'm not going to really talk about those things, although in addictions, the brain really as a whole contributes to it. But the two major places I'm going to talk about are the two main parts that are recognized in substance abuse disorder, as well as many other issues such as attention deficit disorder, anxiety, social anxiety, bipolar, la, la, la. So, anyway, more and more and more. So, the two main areas are the prefrontal cortex. For those without a picture, that is the area just behind your forehead. It goes back a good distance. The prefrontal cortex is where self-awareness is located. That's all over executive decision-making. It's logic. It's how you take two pieces of information, weigh them out, decide which one's the better choice, and then go do it. And all of us have been a little foggy on that sometimes in some way or another. And that really comes into play, as you'll see in a little bit. Also in the prefrontal cortex, impulsivity, emotional inhibition, judgment is in there. But there's two really important jobs that the prefrontal cortex has. There's many more, of course, but for us, there's two. One of them is executive functioning, which is decision-making, concentration, alertness, things like that. But the second one is inhibition of the limbic system. The limbic system is the number two place on that picture on the fourth slide. The limbic system is right in the center of our head, basically. It's right in between our ears. It's about the size of your fist, roughly. It's a little smaller, but it gives you an idea. So in there, that's the second part of our, the brain is kind of separated into three parts. The first part is the prefrontal cortex. That's logic. Human beings have that, mostly. And that gives us that decision making, able to understand language and la la la, right? The second part of the brain is the limbic system, and it is more instinctual part of the brain. So, it's the part of the brain, I'm sure you guys, some of you have heard of the fight, flight, fear response. Fight, flight, and freeze. A lot of people in school have heard that, or if they've had a basic psych class, or if you've done a little bit of research on the internet. That's where that is in the limbic system. So that's where threat response is. The reward system is in there. Anxiety is in there. Rage and anger is in there. Pleasure seeking is in there, from sex to just doing something that's nice and fun and pleasurable, or looking onto the face of the person that you love, or your children. That's in there. And so that's a very important part of our brain, even though a good bit of that is unconsciously driven. Emotional memory is in there. Emotional memory, that's where we see a lot of the seat of post-traumatic stress disorder, electrically, now I'm saying. We'll see the hippocampus is enlarged a little bit, and the fear and anxiety is in there, remember, in the limbic system. So that's has a lot to do with post-traumatic stress disorder. It's starting to, I'm just hoping I can paint a clear enough picture. So we've got two parts of the brain that are very intricate in addiction. So the first is the prefrontal cortex, which has to do with decision-making, is the number one part of it. The number two part of it is its job is to inhibit or stop or slow down the limbic system from just doing whatever it wants to do, right? And so that leads us back to the second part of the brain, which is the limbic system. And that has to do with anxiety, fear, pleasure, protection, things like that. Okay, so in the limbic system, just to go a little bit deeper, not too much, because I don't want to get too crazy into wording, are the pleasure pathway is back there. And so that's where desire-seeking behaviors are located. So not only do we feel pleasure there, but also that's where our brain can start to want to seek out that pleasure. And it's kind of driven by the limbic system. So the second part of the limbic system to talk about is a little lower. It's a little further down in the limbic system. And that's where the amygdala is and those kind of things. And that's simply the alarm system of the brain. And so that part of the brain can activate stress or alarm or fear or something like that. And then the third part of the limbic system out in there is the defense area. It's kind of all the same thing, but it does two different things. So one is it can cause stress or anxiety. It can cause anxiety over a situation, or it can cause us to defend against that situation, whether that defense is an actual defense against it, like I'm going to stand against it, fight against it, or I'm going to get away from it. Those are both a defensive mechanism. Either way, we're getting ourselves out of that bad situation, right? So that's the two major parts that we want to talk about today. Now, on the fifth slide, this is where I'm going to explain. So I'm just explaining a little bit of each ingredient of what we're going to talk about. On the fifth slide, here's a picture. These are four different bands of electrical currents. Now, this is what our brain basically, these are the four major bands that we experience. So the top one is the slowest and biggest, and it is delta. It's called delta. It's 2 to 4 hertz in the brain. Now, in delta, you should really be asleep at this point, far into sleep. The brain is healing in delta. Those kind of things are happening. So if you're in delta, you're not hanging out and having a good time. You're sound asleep. The next one up is the next one down on the picture, but up in currency is going to be, it's also sleeping, but it can be daydreaming. It's kind of that, it can be that in-between stage, really. It's called theta. And theta can be that in-between stage. It's just a little closer to consciousness. High theta, you could actually be a little conscious. So the next one up from that is called alpha. Alpha is 8 to 10 hertz. Alpha is relaxation. It can be meditation. It's also, this is what the brain looks like if someone has smoked weed. So if someone smoked marijuana, the brain is covered in alpha. Pretty interesting, isn't it? So the next one up from that is high beta. So, well, it's kind of beta to high beta. And high end of beta is where we see anxiety, things like that. So we see people are very, very anxious or having an anxiety attack can be way up there, things like that. So if you go to the next slide, which is the same picture, but in this picture, right in between alpha and beta, so it's actually kind of a low beta is really what it is, and often it's called a cognitive beta. That's where we really want to be to live life. So if you're taking a test or if you're learning something, it can be. There's other things that come into play, but if you're just doing really well, you're having a good normal day, that's cognitive beta. You're just kind of in there, you know. You're not asleep. You're not like super excited. You're just awake. You feel good. You're aware. Those kind of things. And so now that we kind of have the basics of the electrical part and the two parts of the brain, the prefrontal and the limbic system, we can kind of get in a little deeper now. So slide number 7. So slide number 7 is talking about addictive mechanisms. These are some of the things that a counselor will sit across from a person and talk about, or you'll learn in school about, and that kind of thing. So I wanted to talk about it and kind of tell it from my point of view, which tends to be a little more straightforward and a little simpler in language and stuff, I mean. So addictive mechanisms, and I hear this argument a lot with marijuana, for instance, physical versus psychological addiction. So the physical addiction has to do with that limbic system. It's the changing of the limbic system. It actually is tissue dependency is where physical addiction comes in, and that's the next term down. Tissue dependency is the adaptation of the body or the brain to a constant presence of a substance in it. So, for instance, cocaine. So if cocaine is in there, then in the brain often, it causes certain things to happen in the brain. And the brain eventually will adjust to that, and it starts to go, hey, this is the normal balance. So you can see a little scale down there at the bottom of this picture. It's just a little scale, and one's tipped to the one side or the other. And what it is if cocaine, here's a much easier way to understand it. Let me put it to you this way. Let's say you take a super strong Advil every day, or any kind of pain, like over-the-counter pain reliever. So if you take that really strong pain reliever every day, eventually your brain starts to just simply go, there's an analgesic here that's coming in through the mouth. Awesome. I don't need to make that anymore. Because, see, your brain makes an analgesic already. It makes a painkiller already, naturally. But if you're putting a painkiller in your body all the time and it gets up into your brain and that substance is there, well, physiologically, the brain will become tissue-dependent on it, meaning it will adjust. And in this case, the brain will stop making the natural painkiller because it's there. It's a waste of energy, for one, to make painkiller if it's already there. And number two, whatever the brain experiences over and over and over, it will adjust to it. It doesn't matter if it is taking a painkiller. It doesn't matter an over-the-counter one. It doesn't matter if it is taking an illegal one or doing cocaine or if you're biting your fingernails or you're eating chocolate or you're having some sort of, or even sex all the time. We hear sex addiction and those things. Those all cause certain neurological events to happen in the brain. Anything that happens to us, any kind of stimulus, will cause the brain to react. And so when it does, and it reacts enough that there's a pattern, the brain will adjust to it. So in this case, it's a painkiller. It's Advil, we'll say, strong Advil. And so the brain just quits making it because it's getting it for free. And so if you stop taking that Advil, though, in about 3 or 4 months, you'll feel like your head's going to blow up and fall off your shoulders because you don't have natural painkiller inside of your brain anymore because the brain has become tissue-dependent on that substance. It's the same thing with cocaine, with oxycodone, with whatever. Marijuana, yes, marijuana is addicting. But that's what's happening. That's what the physical part of it is. That's that physical addiction that we hear about. Speaking of marijuana, that's the main argument I hear is, well, it's only psychologically addicting, not physically addicting. Well, the problem with that is the psychology of a brain, and the physical part of the brain, you can't separate them. They go hand in hand. One drives the other. And so if you have a physical addiction happening to a really strong Advil or whatever, then the psychological part is going to fall into place. The easiest way, I mean, this is a little over the top, but the easiest way I can think to explain the difference between psychological and physical, actually the similarities between them, is that if a person got a brain injury, depending on where they got injured in the brain, their psyche would change. Depending on how severe it was too, but it would change according to how the new brain structure was. So the physical drives the psychological part of the brain. If a person thinks something enough about themselves or hears something enough, whether it's a compliment or a cut down if they hear it enough, and it's a constant stimulus to us, eventually it's going to change that part of our brain is going to start changing, and the psychological part will actually cause the brain to start changing structure. Since we hear this all the time, and this is psychologically changing our personality, even though it may be very, very subtle, if that happens, the brain will actually change its structure a little bit, whether it's electrical or even the real estate, meaning it may get a little bigger, that part of the brain might, or it might get a little less if it's, it may get a little smaller, shrink. And so you can't really separate them. I mean, you can, and you can make sense of it, and it's logical, but when you dive deep enough, they drive each other. One, if one changes, it will drive the other. So when you hear doctors and counselors talking about that stuff, keep those things in mind. So the conditioned response is the psychological side of it. And the conditioned response, it goes back to what we were talking about in slide 4, which are the number 1 and number 2, those two main places that have to do with addiction, the prefrontal cortex and the limbic system. Conditioned response is, I'm just going to read it because it's a great definition, is any stimulus experienced repetitively or that has a strong enough impact on our brain begins to change our structure accordingly, which simply changes our physical brain. So they go hand in hand. You just can't separate them. I mean, you can if you really have to. But when it goes deep enough, they drive each other. And it's important to know that even in the most simple of ways. I mean, you don't have to get into it real deep. We could go into serotonin and dopamine and all the language that has to do with science and the anatomy of the brain. But the truth is, it's just very simply understanding it. You have 4 electrical currents in your brain, basically, and they all kind of move in between those. And if those electrical currents are too slow, you're not going to think well, or you're going to be sleepy and tired all the time. If they're too high, you're going to be anxious. And, I mean, it's really that simple. The addictive mechanisms of the brain, here's the simple way to put what all that stuff I just talked about. If you experience something, whether it's someone telling you something, you thinking something about yourself or an event, or whatever, you're experiencing whatever it is, if you experience it enough, over and over and over, or if it isn't a strong enough event that happens, experience that happens to you, it will change you. It will change your brain, and your brain will begin to change its structure and change the way it works. It just will. So, now that we kind of know that and we got those basics down, we're going to move to the next slide, which is slide 8. Now, slide 8 shows what happens when there is too much slow activity in the prefrontal cortex. The prefrontal cortex, and now it seems like I'm talking around addictions, right? But not at all. Because what we see in people who have or are experiencing addictions, and I said have because the brain will kind of stall on these areas for a while. So it's important to know that, and I'll get into that in a little bit. But people who have or are dealing with addictions will normally have too much slow-wave activity in the prefrontal cortex. So what happens when we have too much slow activity in the prefrontal cortex? Exactly what is on that slide, which is people will experience fogginess, poor decision-making. They'll be impulsive, lack of motivation to go to work, to go to school. Depending on how much slow-wave activity, it could be to take care of our children. It could be to be with the people we love and those kind of things. If there's too much slow-wave activity in the prefrontal cortex, that's also the location we see with depression, which actually I have a picture of that later. So remember, when we go back to what I was teaching in the very beginning, the prefrontal cortex's main jobs are thinking, you know, just being, making decision stuff, which we just addressed here, fogginess, impulsivity, and all that stuff kind of is counteractive to that. The second main job of the prefrontal cortex is to inhibit the limbic system. So if the prefrontal cortex is too sleepy, if I'm a guard at a building and someone wants to come in and rob it, and I'm standing there and I'm really, really daggone sleepy and I can't keep my eyes awake, and that guy comes up, or, you know, I'm not going to be able to stop them. I might be dreaming at that point and off in snooze land. So that's now you see how it's kind of tying together now. So if there's too much sleepiness in the prefrontal cortex to stop the limbic system from doing whatever it wants, then we go to the next slide, which is number 9. Now, number 9 shows a picture of a brain with a fire in the middle of it. Remember, in the middle of the brain, is that's where the limbic system is. So people generally, now all brains are a little bit different, but generally, people who have an addictions issue or who have had an addictions issue often will have a very fast pattern. That high beta I was telling you about, with anxiety and anxiousness and those kind of things, what we see is in the brain, in the middle, in the limbic system, they have too much fast wave activity in that part of the brain. What happens if you have too much fast wave activity in the limbic system? Exactly what I just told you. Anxiety, anger, rage. It can drive impulsivity. And you have, those people can have a heightened flight or fight response. This is really the part that's driving a person to use again, or is making them feel like, I've got to get this or I'm going to die. I've got to get this to feel better. I've got to get this or I don't feel normal. Because in that part of the brain, remember, that's the fight, flight, and freeze response is all in there. And pleasure. That's where the seed of addictions really is, okay? And so there's, when a person becomes, starts to experience addiction, what we see in the limbic system is, we see that part of the brain is driving some very strong forces. Number one, the pleasure pathway is in that part of the brain. The pleasure pathway is dopamine related, meaning that dopamine is just a neurotransmitter that makes us feel super, super good. So when we do a drug, for instance, when a person does cocaine, cocaine goes up into the brain. It causes the brain to drop a ton of dopamine in the brain. We are getting high off of dopamine, not off of cocaine. So we're having this massive, massive pleasure experience that really is humanly impossible to reach on our own. If you look at the human orgasm, so the human being's orgasm is 100% of the dopamine release that we can reach, let's say, which I believe it is. But so if that's 100% of how high we can get, how good we can feel off of just natural experience, cocaine is about 200% higher than that. Meth is about 1,200% higher than that. Higher than we can naturally ever obtain on our own. So you can see how insanely intense that those drugs affect the pleasure pathway. So now, our brains are built, at least that part of our brain, which is a huge part of our brain, is in its workings, not size, but it is built for protection or pleasure. That's it. Fight, flight, and freeze, which is protection, and pleasure, which is sex or feeling good or whatever. And so that's a massive part of what our brain is pleasure. So when we're reaching these massive amounts of pleasure, it latches on quickly. So that's the first mechanism, is pleasure pleasure-seeking, it becomes like, that was amazing. I want to get that again. I need to feel that again. Oh, my gosh, I love it. So you've got this pleasure-seeking, this desire-seeking pathway that's way stronger than even our own sex drive. So that's, even by itself, that's a huge mechanism towards addiction. Then at the same time, our brain has become tissue-dependent, or is becoming tissue-dependent on that drug. And so it's starting to get out of balance. Now, the problem with tissue dependence is the brain doesn't believe it's out of balance anymore. So if you could picture a scale like that was on number 7 slide, that scale, if it were straight across, that would be balanced. So both sides are equal. But then you start taking that Advil, remember, and you keep taking that Advil, and the scale starts tipping one direction. The problem with the brain is that it believes that that new imbalance is the new balance. So now, oh, this is balanced. This is how it should be. And so if it's cocaine or whatever, heroin, or just doesn't really matter, whatever drug that is, now when a person stops taking it or when it gets out of the system, it will automatically start to go back to a balanced state, right, to our normal balanced state. But the brain doesn't believe that that's balanced anymore. So when it starts to try to go back to its natural setting, the brain starts to panic a little bit because that's not normal anymore. So the amygdala, which is, remember I said, was anxiety, it's the alarm system of the brain, is activated. It's activated really strongly, and so you've got this pleasure-seeking part of the brain that's like, I want that. I want that more than sex. I want it more than food. I want it. And then you've got this other part of the brain that is built to protect us, going, you've got to get it, because if you don't, there's a chance you could die, or there's a chance that something really bad could happen. And now these are unconscious parts of the brain, so we're not sitting around going, well, sure, that makes total sense, that, you know, this is driven deep inside of us. Now remember, most people who have issues with substances have a slow prefrontal cortex, remember, not slow prefrontal, but too much slow wave in the prefrontal. So they have fogginess. So when that limbic system says, hey, I've got an alarm down here, this drug is going out of my system and out of this area, I don't like it, and it's freaking me out, am I going to die? And so it sends a signal up to the prefrontal cortex, and the prefrontal cortex, it, just like that sleepy guard protecting that building, says, it's supposed to go, no, you're not experiencing this, or you are, but it's not right. You need to calm down a little bit. But since the guard is too sleepy, when the alarm goes back and says, hey, is this for real? The alarm goes back to the amygdala and the whole limbic system, and there's no answer on it because this guard's kind of foggy. And so the limbic system says, oh, no answer, it's for real, can't take a chance. We really need it now. Yeah, for sure, we're going to die if we don't get it. So in a really kind of nutshell kind of way, that's what addiction really is. I mean, you can explain this so much deeper if you want. And I know there are some doctors on here that could do that. I could do that too. But this is the Tim Trail easy bake oven kind of way to get things done. To understand things. And so it just makes a lot of sense if we can break it down to a much easier level. The limbic system, too hot, too much on fire, needs it now, feels like you're going to die, anxiety through the roof. The prefrontal cortex, not only is it foggy and it can't answer the limbic system, but also impulsivity is there. Like, oh my gosh, I want to do it now. Poor decision making is there. Starting to deal with depression or anxiety and those kind of things, and which are not experienced when a person's on drugs. So, I mean, drugs naturally change the brain to where you don't experience those things. So the brain, that's the answer. I mean, it can be the answer. It feels like it's the answer, I'm sorry. Well, so the next slide, number 10, just says, now that we've identified the basis of addiction, what's next? And so that leads me to number 11. So go ahead and go to slide 11. And there's a few things here. That's the basic of addictions, but more than that, we're talking about brain changing. So if a person uses drugs, depending on which drug, it can slowly change the brain or it can very quickly change the brain. The issue is for most part, the brain takes a long time to change back. It doesn't just quickly change. A person doesn't quit using a drug and then just, you know, go through 30 days of rehab and woohoo, there you go, I'm better. Pleasure pathway, you know, when a person does something, anything, a new neural pathway is formed. That new neural pathway, for pretty much what we know in science right now, I mean, science constantly changes. There could be a new information out there. I don't know right now, but pretty much what we know is those neural pathways don't ever go away. And they can get weaker. They can almost just be gone to where you don't even feel like they're there anymore and they don't really activate anymore. But for the most part, they are still there. And so they can reactivate. They can nag you for a while, you know, things like that. And so what we're seeing is 20, 30 days, 60 days in treatment is really can be just long enough to kind of get us ready to experience a ton of emotion or this flood of, you know, as our brain starts to try to balance back out, we can experience panic and we can experience, you know, working in treatment centers and working with patients, a lot of time when I see people who are recovering from alcohol use, heavy alcohol dependency, or cocaine or whatever, I will often see people diagnosed with bipolar or anxiety or depression or both, or so forth and so on. Or they'll have ADHD and things like that, and that's because the brain is still out of focus a little bit. It takes time. Go to the next slide. This is a great example, brilliant example. So, oh, I forgot to put the sighting on there. I'm so sorry. If anybody wants the research on it, if you'll shoot me an email, I'll get it to you, which university this was. But this is marijuana. 67 participants, they started using marijuana when they were 16 or 17 years old. Average time of use was one time per day. They used for 3 years. They stopped at somewhere between 19 and 20 years old, so they used for 3 years straight, completely stopped. That is the brain of a human being 2 years after they've stopped. And I still hear people going, well, you know, it takes about 3 months to get it out of your brain. Maybe if you're smoking once, sure. But if people are smoking regular, it's a lot longer lasting than we thought. Of course, they've healed a lot since, you know, then, and this is a huge, huge difference. But even marijuana, I mean, the media's going on so much about how wonderful it is and doesn't do anything is a lot. So if we go to the next slide, which says one big issue, which is where I was going to get to, but the 14th slide talks about some alternative ways that we can strengthen the brain. So this is after treatment, or even during treatment. So one of them is called the CORE method, C-O-O-R, which is Conditioned Object Oriented Relaxation. Now the next page gives you extremely wordy but clear definition on how to do it. Mindful meditation, I'm going to be real brief on it. I'm going to be real brief on all of these actually, but mindful meditation, nothing to do with religion or any of that kind of stuff, has been shown in, if you do 10 minutes a day in 8 weeks, your cells in your body are more round. That's amazing, which means they make energy, ATP, more efficiently, and you have less chance of blood clotting. That's unbelievable to me. In 8 weeks, on average, over 2,000 of a person's genes will have begun to express themselves differently in a person who does mindful meditation for 10 minutes a day for 8 weeks. And these are not people who are forced to do it, so you know they didn't do it every day. That's it. I mean, over 2,000 genes, we don't know them all, but the ones we do know about are self-control, self-awareness, happiness, joy, things like that. So things are really important. It's the things in the prefrontal cortex that we need to work out, that we need to get stronger. Now, 16, the next slide, is neurofeedback. Neurofeedback is something I've been really into. We had a great laboratory here on campus that shut down just a few months ago. I'm very, very upset. But but that looks at the electrical side of the brain. And here's just a couple examples. The next two slides are the last two, and they're just the examples. But let's say that's the brain of someone who has addictions as their main issue. And you can see that that red area, especially in the first ones, is going to be, and this is not one I couldn't find a really good solid slide on it right away. But what we do see is we see a really red or yellowish area right down the center of the head, especially in the limbic system. It's just very, very hot. And then the prefrontal cortex will see a very, very slow pattern, just like I described it. And neurofeedback is very amazing. It can be supplementing for treatment or helping, I mean, along with treatment. And just go to 18. So slide 18, a lot of times I told you earlier, we'll see once the brain starts to settle out, all of a sudden we see these odd patterns, different patterns in the brain. What you're seeing right there is depression. That's what a human being's brain looks like with depression. You can see it. It's like a huge target right there. But, you know, I could have given you 100 million examples, and I don't want to overfill your brains and stuff, but roughly it's just that simple. The brain, the prefrontal cortex, too slow. We need to work it out. It's like a muscle, you know, to just work it out. And you can change these things. We can see it. Whether it's through mindful meditation alone or neurofeedback alone or one face-to-face counseling, we've seen massive brain changes in people. And so these are all options. I know that this is a very basic presentation, and it was kind of wordy, I know. But I think that keeping it very basic can make it very simple, make it very easy, and we can... we can attack this in a very different way. I don't want to go on forever. I want to be able to have the questionnaire done in time, and also I want to hopefully have a chance to answer questions if anyone has any questions. So, Amy, I will turn it over to you or whoever needs to take over. I really appreciate it. Thank you so, so very much. Thank you.
Thank you. To help us evaluate and improve our program, please complete the following short survey. If you are a Cigna employee, we ask that you please refrain from participating in this survey. After the last question, there will be an opportunity for you to ask questions. Your individual responses will be kept confidential. Please tell us to the degree to which you agree or disagree with the following statements. Question number one. This session taught me about how the brain is affected by addiction problems. Press star 1, strongly agree, star 2, agree, star 3, disagree, and star 4, strongly disagree. Thank you. Question number two. This session educated me about problems that can linger after stopping substance abuse and coping skills I can use. Press star 1, strongly agree. That is star 2, agree. Star 3, disagree. And star 4, strongly disagree. And question number three, overall this session met my expectations. Please select one of the following responses. That is star 1, strongly agree, star 2, agree, star 3, disagree, and star 4, strongly disagree. question number 4. I would recommend this program to others. Star 1, press 1 if you agree, or star 2 if you do not agree. And question number 5, please select the response that best describes your role in the life of an individual with substance abuse issues. That is star 1, I am a person with a substance abuse issue. Star 2, I am a family member of someone with a substance abuse issue. Question number 3, I am a treatment provider for someone with a substance abuse issue. And star 4 for other. Thank you for your feedback and for participating in our program. If you would like to make any additional comments to help us improve this program, or if you have any questions on today's topic, please press star 1 to have your line open into the conference. Once again, that is star 1 if you would like to ask a question. And we'll go ahead and take our first caller. Please go ahead.
Hi, thank you very much for making that so simple. And then a question popped up for me. There's other, I guess, medications and things like even over-the-counters that have another effect on the brain, and I wondered what explains it, since sometimes after it builds up you don't need as much. Sometimes things like melatonin or antidepressants, they build up and then you don't need as much.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's where the tissue dependency can come in play a lot. Melatonin specifically is very interesting because...
Yes.
well, there's a few things to know about it. A lot of people don't know, and I'll just put it out real quick. Melatonin is a biphasic drug. So is alcohol, by the way. In alcohol, it's very low amounts. Alcohol is actually a stimulant. In very high amounts, it's, well, not very high, but medium to higher amounts, it's a depressant, but it can't be both. Now, with melatonin, it's sort of the same thing, but it has to do with light. And so if you take melatonin, you go to bed, and you're in complete darkness, it actually will become that depressant you need to go to sleep. And if you look at light, like your phone or anything, if any light hits your eyes, hits your cerebral lobes, then melatonin actually turns into a stimulant.
Hmm.
And so people tell me all the time, oh, I'll take it, but I'm up till 2 or 3 in the morning. I'm like, oh, yeah. You look at your phone? Yeah, that makes sense. So, but, yeah, melatonin, many over-the-counter drugs, people do become, they can build up a tolerance to it. You're right. It's the same as alcohol. When a person first starts drinking, they drink 2 drinks and it puts them on their hind end. You know, they're pretty wasted. But 3 years later and they drink 6 and they're like, eh, I have to drink at least another 2 before I even feel it. The body can build up a tolerance to it. And it's the same with antidepressants and there are some ADHD medications that we see that with. I mean, I can't get too deep into it. I don't have enough time, but yeah, we do. With things like melatonin, though, you shouldn't, what I believe I've read is don't go over 2 weeks. So you should do 2 weeks with melatonin and then take off 2 weeks. Or you can switch to valerian root for 2 weeks and then take off 2 weeks and then go back to, you know, melatonin after 6 weeks and then valerian root again and then off for 2 more weeks and like that. I wish I could get into it. That's really fascinating to me also.
Thank you.
Sure.
And ladies and gentlemen, as a reminder, it is star 1 to ask a question. That is star 1. And we'll go ahead and take our next caller. Please go ahead.
Tim. My name is Rick Rail. I'm the director of pharmacy at University of Behavioral Health here in Denton.
Yeah.
Close to where you are.
Yeah.
I am curious about the research that's being done on drugs like Neurontin and Topamax that seems like they're helping reestablish the pathways between the limbic system and the cerebral cortex. Do you have any information on that?
I don't have any of the research right on my fingertips, so I can't talk to a lot of it. I know there is a lot in it, though. I know that, I mean, personally, this is just my own opinion, but I can't see anything scientifically or for anyone else, but I do see positive things in that, and there's a couple of other of natural substances that we're starting to see that are helping with heroin and especially coming off and kind of giving people back on track and stuff. But it's how do we do that in a healthy way? How do we do it where it's not a long-term, you know, doesn't become that long-term addiction, you know, just one for another kind of thing. But there's I'm really interested in it. I really stay kind of on this side of the research of it. I dedicate a lot of time to this and meditation and the neurological side and QEGs and things like that. But I'm really excited to see as we get more and more research out. I know we're starting to build up quite a bit. I'm sorry I can't be more helpful, but it's really good to talk to you. We're right down the street from each other.
Yes, I did a talk yesterday on addiction pharmacology where I talked about the drugs used to treat addictions. And I'm always looking to gain more information because we're, you know, as we move this to the medical model and away from a moral issue, I think the information that we do have drugs that can help with substance abuse treatment at all the different stages is information that we need to have out there.
Yeah. And we are, and that's another exciting thing is we're moving away from just kind of, you know, here's somebody, pop them on some stuff, talk to them a little bit, see ya, you know, to exactly what you're talking about, the stages. We're starting to break it down. We're really tackling the issue instead of kind of, you know, I think we've been a little bit in the dark in the past, and the last several years have just been leaps and bounds of the discoveries we keep coming across. I'm really excited about it.
Well, I'll email you and keep in touch.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. That'd be wonderful.
All right. Thank you for the program today.
Oh, my pleasure.
And we'll take our next question from? Caller, your line is now open. Caller, if your line is muted, please unmute your phone line. Okay, we'll proceed to the next question. We will take our next question from.
Hi, my name's Dottie. I have a question about this new form of marijuana the kids are doing called Brax.
Yeah, it's not new.
I've been hearing a lot about it. I have this issue with my child, and he's been doing this every day for 3 years, and he's 17. So I'm trying to figure out to get some facts together to try to help him. He tells me it's not addictive. Obviously, there's issues with his behavior that has changed. So
sure.
Is there anything you can tell me that's different between that and marijuana that I should be aware of?
Well, if you're in Texas, it's an automatic felony if you're caught with it, is the first thing.
Okay.
Any oils or waxes are an automatic felony. So, because we have laws in Texas, I don't know what state you're in or
Virginia.
Okay, but that's the first thing I would look at is laws.
Okay.
Because oils and wax, we call them dabs here in Texas, and it's the same thing: cheddar, wax, butter. It's all the same thing. First thing is look at the law because they're really steep in most states and it's not legal yet. So, and that's because it's such a high concentration of THC. One of the issues we have is that when we educate people, we either come from that really far side of weed's evil and your face is going to explode, or it's completely natural and didn't do anything and it's not addicting at all. And both arguments kind of drive each other. And the key, I believe one of the keys is really educating people, and getting down to it. Dabs is, or wax, for one, it's a massively strong form of marijuana. It is addicting. It isn't addicting for everyone, though. The thing is, if he's been doing it every day, he's absolutely got tissue dependency. Because tissue dependency is just tissue dependency. There's no way around it. You can get tissue dependency to aspirin, good grief, you know.
Right, okay.
So there's that. And email me, too, and I'll send you a lot more information. Sure. And the thing with marijuana is, like I was talking about in cocaine, we use cocaine, it goes to the brain, causes a huge amount of dopamine to drop. We get half of dopamine, not cocaine. Marijuana is not like that. Marijuana actually jumps in our receptors, THC does, and it binds in there, and we get high off of marijuana. And because of that, there are a few things that happen that cause that long-term changes we see neurologically. So I don't know. I mean, I would get with a professional near you for sure and see how you should attack it. But in my opinion, I talk to a lot of families here at the university, and especially for families, just jumping in there and going, that is addicting, and you know, and you probably are and stuff is usually not, it cannot be helpful. It can be counterproductive. Instead of just really, you know, getting some of the research I've got, I'll send it to you, getting some other stuff and starting to share that with them.
Is this something, he tells me no one's ever overdosed on this, because of course you worry about that. Is that factual?
Well, sort of. No one's ever died on it that I know of yet. Of course, science is changing quick. But the THC is so high now, we have had people, mostly it's young people who are eating it, who are not, their brains are just not, you know, ready to handle that. Have went to, I believe there's been a couple of cases of coma that I've seen. I believe. I mean, I really research into that. But we're starting to see that these really strong. And another thing with wax is that it's made with butane. You know, you have to use a butane to get it out. So you're getting butane into your system, too. There are carcinogens in marijuana, which are cancer-causing agents. There are, you know, it does change our brain, but it doesn't change it in the way that I was taught when I was young. You know, I was afraid it would kill me.
Right,
and
okay.
I would die, but that's just not the truth. So,
okay. I will email you for more information. That would be great.
That would be wonderful.
Yeah, thank you for your time. I appreciate it.
Oh, my pleasure. My pleasure.
Okay. And we'll go ahead and take our next caller. Please go ahead.
Hi, I have a similar question about resetting the brain, and one of the workshops or trainings I attended was the Feeling State Addiction Protocol, and I wondered if you've seen any research that has shown, say, the impact of brains, say, before treatment and after treatment.
Yeah, I mean, there were a few, and I'm sure there are plenty more. Of before and after treatment. Honestly, though, treatment is not long enough to really, I mean, the brain's going to be, it depends what treatment you go to, but 30 days, 60 days even, you're going to see a pretty good change in the brain, especially if it's marijuana or something like that. But long-term is what we got to look for. Because the brain will change, but for most individuals, the brain will have imbalance to it if we don't actively go in there and continue to change it. I don't know if I'm going down the right path for you with what I'm saying, but is that kind of going where you want to go with it? Or?
Yeah, and the idea that if treated and the reward and pain center goes back to maybe the homeostasis of before or a new good enough normal, if there's actually, I guess, that research that shows that how the brain recovers so that it can, say, encourage clients to repair and stick with the work it takes.
Yeah. Yeah. There's an example I give a lot, and I hope nobody's listening will get really mad at me, but this is not meant to be a bad thing for AA at all, or NA, or any of the programs. But sometimes individuals, it's not necessarily a program maybe, but it's the individuals who get in those, who they go through treatment or they get cleaner or sober in whatever way they do, and then they get stuck in this, because their brain is going to change a good bit just by stop using, of course. But then that wherever they settle, whether it's, you know, anxious or maybe depressive state or maybe stuck in that foggy state or whatever it is, or bipolar or whatever, or even if it's a subtle, you know, I'm not saying they have to have those things, but just like it's an up and down and it's kind of like, oh, it's either all or nothing and, you know, those kind of things. Being in a place where they start to get into a habit of just saying over and over, I'm this way and I'm always going to be this way. Like I said before, anything that the brain experiences repetitive in a repetitive manner, it will change accordingly. And so if a person, you know, if I say, I'm just a poor little this, and I'll always be dumb, and I'm, oh, my gosh, and, well, you know what? My brain's going to match it. It's going to go that way. I might not be a dumb person, but I'm going to think foggier. I'm going to have a harder time recollecting words that I need, recalling, harder time forming memories, things like that. I mean, the brain just changes. It just does. It does whatever we tell it to or whatever it experiences over and over and over. And so it can be the same thing. And like you said, getting into that program that you had mentioned or any of them that helps to exercise the brain helps get us beyond, you know, just where we got out of treatment at or whatever, or that face-to-face talk therapy too. Heck yeah, there's a lot of research on that that shows great efficacy coming out of talk therapy. So yeah, I mean, we've got to work towards getting our brains even healthier once we get out. We can't just stop and go, well, I'm better now. You know, we've got to keep changing that brain. I hope that
great,
was...
thank you.
Sure.
And we'll take our next question. Caller, please, go ahead.
Oh, I would like to ask about a Compressate or Campral. What's its status now? It had some early wonderful results back in Europe years ago. And now I've heard that it's not so effective at getting GABA going and calming people down so that they can resist the cravings of alcohol.
Yeah, I really don't know. I haven't been staying up on it. Sorry.
Well, can I ask you one more thing?
Absolutely.
Have you heard of Smart Recovery, self-management and recovery training?
Yes.
Would you recommend it to people?
Yes. Yeah.
Thank you so much.
Sure, certainly.
And with no further questions in queue, I'd like to turn the conference back over to Ms. Amy Papageorge for closing remarks.
Thank you so much for attending, and thank you, Tim, for speaking today. If you have additional questions for our speaker, please contact him at the web address listed on today's PowerPoint. If you have specific questions regarding treatment or your policy, please contact the outpatient team by calling the number on the back of your insurance card. Our next seminar will be February 18th. If you haven't already done so, please feel free to listen to the replays of any of the past year's seminars and be sure to sign up to receive automatic email reminders for our upcoming sessions. Thank you.
And ladies and gentlemen, that does conclude today's conference. We do thank you for your participation. You may now disconnect. Have a great rest of your day.